Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. Leading into the long Memorial Day weekend, I'm continuing our bi-weekly series focused on American history. Last episode focused on Harry Truman's leadership of the World War II era Truman Committee that offers the perfect model for accountability and anti-corruption efforts in the defense industry. Today's episode is with return guest and veteran Elliot Ackerman, who came on before to discuss his previous books, The Fifth Act, America's End in Afghanistan, and 2034, a novel of the next world war. His new book, Halcyon, is a fictionalized alternate history of the United States in the 2000s. It deals with, and our conversation focuses on, the legacy of history, debates over how America should understand the legacy of the Civil War, and how individuals grapple with getting left behind amidst change. Lots of great stuff here. Hope you all enjoy this conversation and the long weekend. And of course, a huge thank you to the Foundation for American Innovation for supporting the work of this podcast. Elliot Ackerman, welcome back to The Realignment.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Marshall.
Yeah, it's great to chat with you. A lot of listeners are going to remember you from our interview about 2034. We then did an interview about your recent book about the withdrawal from Kabul / Afghanistan. Now you have a new book out this week called Halcyon. And quick note, because you dropped this in a Q&A you did with your publisher, there's actually going to be a sequel to 2034 out. And I know, I'll tell you, that was actually our best-selling book from our bookshop. So I know, can you just do a quick 2054 shout out? Because that's what listeners should really bookmark before we go in.
Sure. It's going to be out in March of next year. So March of 2024, but the title of the book is 2054. So it takes us 20 years into the future. And as much as 2034 was a story that was about a war with China, and the issues of cyber and how they would factor into that war, 2054 is a novel with many of the same characters and some new ones, but it is about civil unrest at home as we veer towards a civil war. And on the tech front, it analyzes artificial intelligence and the integration of biological evolution and technological evolution sort of towards the singularity. So I'm excited for it. I think it's a fun read and takes the 2034 narratives forward.
And that's actually the perfect transition to the actual book. I'm surprised we were able to pull this off, but you were just talking about the future. Halcyon is really much, really a book about the past. So how about you just kind of like introduce the work, but how it fits into the broad set of writing you've put out just the past few years?
Well, Halcyon it's a novel that's set in an alternate 2004. And in this 2004, Al Gore is president, and we have figured out how to resurrect people from the dead. And the title of the novel comes from the name of an estate where one of the key characters, Robert Abelson, lives. And he's one of these people who is in a who has been part of this prototype movement to bring individuals back from the dead. So if the reader will bear with me on those sort of scientific leaps and science fiction leaps of faith, you know, what the novel is really about is about how we judge people from other times in our own times. And so Robert Abelson, this character who we meet early on in the book, he's a man who was very well regarded in his own time, but he is now living out of time and struggling to keep up with social conventions as they've changed rapidly all around him.
How old are you, if you don't mind me asking?
No, I'm 43.
So you're 43. Okay. So to what degree does the whole like person out of time argument resonate with you? Just because like I'm a middle millennial, I'm 31. So like very clearly I'm a little outside like Gen Z dynamics, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So how does this idea of like being out of time like apply to your life now?
I'll give you kind of the nexus of this book. You know, each one of my books starts a little bit differently, but my wife, her mother and her father had a pretty significant age difference, more than 25 years. And so her father, who I never met, was a World War II veteran. He served in the OSS, He actually was part of the group that rescued some of the Doolittle Raiders out of occupied China. Wow. And then he came back from World War II, had this, you know, whole other career as a lawyer in Delaware, and kind of like an Atticus Lish type or Atticus French type character. Sorry. And, you know, it was just beloved. I mean, the one thing, you know, in his family and in my wife's community is like he is a guy who they talk about to this day in reverential tones. And so being part of her family, you know, I have been living with this very present memory of him. And there's this always been this refrain of, you know, what do you think daddy would think about X? Or what do you think daddy would think about Y? And that refrain is particularly sped up, you know, as the last few years, the country's gone through a whole number of social upheavals. So I had a very intense dream just a few years ago. Because one of my regrets is that I never had the chance to meet him, where he and I just had a conversation in this dream. I mean, as in focus as though we were sitting across the table from one another. And we talked about a whole host of issues, but I sort of woke up from that dream. And this idea of a man living out of time just kept lingering with me. So really with the novel, what I wanted to do was to set up an alternate reality and an alternate past to sort of see how a person, you know, who is not my father-in-law, but is someone who was beloved in his own time, how he would survive in a time that was not his own. And so the little piece of alternate history that I play with is we look back historically speaking, I think everyone can agree that the 2000 election was a real fork in the road for the country that was decided by a little over 500 votes in Florida. And so in my alternate 2004, when Gore wins the election, one of the things we've forgotten is that when Bush actually won that election, the year before we had mapped the human genome. So that happened in 1999. And that opened up a whole slew of research to include research into cloning and cryonics. And when Bush became president, he shut down all that research because of his religious beliefs. So a lot of that was all rolled back. And so in my alternate 2004, when Gore wins, none of that research gets rolled back. And there's this sort of innovation that allows this individual, Robert Abelson, to sort of come back and walk around in a time that's not his own. And then he's very quickly enmeshed in a number of controversies. One has to do with Civil War monuments. Another one has to do with sort of a chapter of his past that gets dredged up that has sort of a Me Too angle on it. But it's really this idea of how difficult it is to judge people out of time, and how when we start dredging up the past and dredging up people who lived in different times, you know, they can start walking around in surprising ways in our own time.
You know, it's really interesting to your point around Bush and the bioethics debates from the early 2000s. When I was interning at AEI back in 2015, one of the last things I did was I had to photocopy Leon Cass's just correspondence from the period. And Leon Cass was one of the leading bioethicists who was like in the middle of like the stem cell research and all of that debate. And this is just a debate that I think is going to be really just, it's been totally memory holed on 15 different levels, especially because it was pretty clearly rejected at an electoral level. You have the famous ad that Michael J. Fox gave in favor of stem cell research. But I'm just curious, let's just like take a step out of the book for a second. What do you like separate from the, you know, this stopped us from having, you know, immortality or reviving people back from the dead. Like, what do you think about that 2002, 2003 era debate around bioethics looking back?
Well, I think it mirrors debates we're having right now on AI, right? There's sort of, you know, a very lively debate going on and real, I think, social anxiety about what artificial intelligence means for the future of the species, in much the same way that the bioethics debate was one that seemed as though it would greatly impact the future of the species. And as you mentioned, it's sort of been memory hold. But I think when I look back at that debate, it reminds me when I look at debates in field media right now that our morals are not fixed. Our sense of what is right and right is wrong is never fixed, even though in the present we seem to reach conclusions as though morality is fixed for all time. And I think that should lead any person to carry with them a certain degree of humility. Because as much as, you know, you or I might feel certain that we're right on issue X or issue Y and that this is now a settled issue, the people who live after us will most assuredly come back and judge us. And to believe that that these issues are fixed in time is, I think, a great fallacy. And so the book is really a story about what it's like to be uprooted in that way, to try to, you know, to try to have someone who's good in their own time come back and live in a time that's not their own, and how that can compromise them. And I think, and I hope that the book will speak to anyone who has felt in the last years, maybe you felt this way, I've certainly felt this way, where suddenly norms of behavior and societal norms are changing so quickly, like we're really struggling to keep up and to understand the earth as it's shifting beneath us on a whole host of issues.
Yeah. And, you know, this isn't going to delve into the realm of spoilers because it's fairly early on in the book, but I really enjoyed the focus on the Civil War and Shelby Foote as a historian. I actually have a copy of his work back there. It's never going to be read, but I got the nice like hardcover thing from the publisher, so it looks cool. So can you really just contextualize Shelby Foote and the 1990s discourse over the Civil War? Because it's a theme in the book, but I think a lot of people aren't going to have context of why Shelby Foote as a historian is a part. I don't want to say like dog whistle, like in an offensive sense, but like, oh yeah, like you're speaking to a big debate that the country kind of went through even before the Trump era stuff.
Well, I mean, when the novel opens, we meet Abelson. And but it's sort of, the narrator is not Robert Abelson. It's a guy named Martin Newman. And he is sort of like a Nick Carraway from The Great Gatsby s narrator who's watching Abelson's story. And but Martin is himself a historian, and he is on sabbatical at Halcyon trying to write his first book. And it is a book about the Civil War, but wrestles with this idea, which is one Shelby Foote would often say in interviews, that the essential genius of America is our ability to compromise. And our one great failure to compromise resulted in the Civil War. And so Martin Abelson is sort of tormented by this question, like, is the genius of America our ability to compromise, or are there certain issues on which there is no compromise, and they truly are black and white? And I think that theme to me resonates with, you know, one of the most essential things in life that is black and white is life and death. And so this is a novel which suddenly the boundary between life and death becomes permeated. So, I mean, you know, Kafka famously said, what gives life meaning is that it ends. So, you know, the characters are sort of wrestling with this. But in the case of Shelby Foote, I think he was a novelist who wrote a three volume, each volume 1,000 pages, so 3,000 page work called The Civil War, A Narrative. And it was really his life's work. And the book came out over, you know, I think the first volume came out in the 60s, the last two sort of in the early 70s and the late 70s. But he was catapulted to fame in Ken Burns's 1991 documentary, The Civil War, which really ran on PBS and made Ken Burns his name, because of the talking heads in The Civil War. Shelby Foote is really, you know, he's probably half of it. And he's a Southerner. He's from Mississippi. Speaks in sort of a low lilting drawl and has all these sort of great one-liners throughout that series. But as much as he sort of was beloved in the 1990s, when that series came out, he's sort of taken a downward turn, recently, because his book is very much the narrative history, which I would encourage someone to read. I in fact did it all a couple years ago on Audible as my New Year's resolution. It was 152 hours on Audible. It took me 9 months. So as an aside, I would recommend it. It's amazing. It's like living the Civil War at 4x speed. So, you know, you're 2 or 3 months into this thing and you're like, I don't know. I don't think the North's going to pull this off. The South's really, you know, kicking their asses. And then, you know, you really live the whole arc of the Civil War. But, you know, so he's, you know, he was sort of a remarkable figure. And I sort of have, he walks on and off of the page in the book, sort of my fictionalized Shelby Foote character. But to me, he's emblematic, again, of a person who, you know, was celebrated in his own time and has recently kind of come out of favor. And I think the Civil War is also important because it's an issue in our history that is probably the least fixed. It's been reinterpreted in a story that's been retold so many times up to today. I mean, we've seen, yeah. I don't think there's any historical period in our time that's been more hotly contested in the last, you know, 5 to 10 years than the Civil War, which happened 150 years ago.
Yeah, no, I think that's just fascinating when you kind of like put it that way, in the sense of every generation is having to relitigate the Civil War. And a perfect example, like look at the Civil Rights Movement. Like obviously there's all sorts of nuance and there's different direction of what happened in the 60s. But in as we saw with AOC and Ted Cruz getting in a fight about like who was responsible for the passages of the Civil Rights Act, there's easy to find, it's actually pretty easy with that case to find like some shared narrative we could share afterwards. Like it's like, this was a good thing, we're all happy, and actually we were the ones who did it. No, we were the ones who did it. That's what that fight is. But with the Civil War, it's actually, what does the word, because even when you said his articulation of compromise, I'm like, like, is compromise a good thing if it's a compromise over slavery? If it's America's genius for compromise, then that seems like that's not a particularly useful genius in that sense. Like, would it have been genius to compromise with the Nazis, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? So it's so interesting that way. Another theme that comes out through the book is this idea, It's an alternate history. So you're focusing on this, but you spend some time writing about Stonewall Jackson, and just sort of the what if Stonewall Jackson had not been accidentally killed by friendly fire in 1862. And you just have this fun line where you basically say, like, if you think about it, there are so many different instances of history being different by just this or that thing happening. You're obviously doing this through the narrator, but for you personally, Elliot, like, what are just some examples that you could just think of throughout like American history? You're like, man, like, I'm really wondering how things could have been different. Maybe it's even in your own life.
Well, I think, and I'll get back to Stonewall Jackson in a second. It's just what you were saying, Marshall, kind of reminded me of several things. Well, first of all, I think, you know, I'm a war veteran. So I think that one of the things that comes out of that experience is you constantly then have this history, you know, if you've seen combat, if you've had friends you've gotten hurt, where you're always rolling over this, like, you know, this should have, could have, would have, like, what if, you know, what if Jonesy hadn't crossed the street that day? What if it's very much part of war, is this, you know, if only this hadn't happened, then this other thing wouldn't have happened. So I think that forces us into these types of frames of mind, which are alternate histories. At the interpersonal level, and then even at the political level. And I think when we look at the Civil War, it's one of these conflicts where our country just, you know, fundamentally goes in a different direction. It's defining. It's, I think, very accurately been called the Second American Revolution. And it's also one where in the years after the Civil War, as you know, I mean, fiercely contested, what was this war about, you know, and the sort of the lost cause-ism has always been, you know, oh, this was a war about states' rights and you Northerners can't come down here and tell us how to live our lives. And then, you know, the Northerner was always, no, this is a war about slavery. You know, we're not going to have slavery in this country anymore. And something that's always been interesting to me is I feel like there's always been this tension in the narratives, like, well, which side is right? You know, this is an argument. It's like, well, in a war, the fact that there are two opposing sides who cannot really agree or don't align on what the war is about is usually the reason you're fighting the war. If everybody agreed what the war was about, you probably wouldn't be fighting a war. Like, let's look at like Russia and Ukraine right now. You know, Russia says Ukraine is part of Russia, and, you know, and Ukraine says, you know, we are our own independent country. They can't even agree what the war is about, and that's why they're fighting a war. And then I think when we look after the fact, how we remember the Civil War, there's all sorts of wrinkles there. So, like, for instance, you know, if you go out on the street today and say, I think to most people, you know, particularly in like the, you know, in sort of more liberal enclaves of the United States, like, hey, should there be Confederate war memorials up in the United States? And most people say no, like, we need to tear all them down, get rid of them. And I would, you know, I agree with that by and large, but it starts to get complicated when you look at the history of some of these memorials. So like I write about this in the book, like most people don't realize that there is a Confederate War Memorial at Arlington National Cemetery. Like the Hallowed of Hallows has a Confederate War Memorial there. And so when you start unpacking, like, well, why is that there? What you realize, the reason that the way that memorial came into being is President McKinley in the late 1800s, after we had fought and won the Spanish-American War, he was the one who put that memorial there. And the reason he did it was, first of all, the Spanish-American War fought in the late 1800s was the first war since the Civil War in which North and South had to fight together again. So the fact that that was even going to happen was not a sure prospect. But they did. But then after the Spanish-American War...
Quick pause. You just triggered one of my favorite like random history facts. One of the... I can't remember his name, but one of... This is in Theodore Roosevelt's biography. This is Edmund Morris's Rise of Theodore Roosevelt. One of the generals who led American troops in the field was a former Confederate veteran. And he would just like... He was kind of senile at that point. And he would just shout about Yankees as they were fighting in the field. So like that's literally what we're doing. This is the literal like reconciling at that sense.
And it's really messy. Like what America looked like at that point. I mean, if you do the imaginative work, like, God, what a messy country we were, or half the country had just fought the other half and they're all still alive. But so when you learn about that memorial, McKinley, they, you know, we win the Spanish-American War and we need a peace treaty, which is the Treaty of Paris. That peace treaty was what basically allowed the expansion of American colonialism in the Philippines and in Cuba. So McKinley, as a champion, is trying to champion American colonialism. The great obstacle to American colonialism at this point were the Southern senators. The Southern states were refusing to ratify this treaty. And so to pander to them, what he did was he said, okay, I'll let you bury Southern soldiers at Arlington National Cemetery. And that was a tool he used to galvanize the South, to ratify the Treaty of Paris, to allow for the colonial expansion. So it's sort of like it's all of these like, you know, very, you know, sort of strange, nasty cross currents that are complex. So the idea that there's just sort of this like, these are the good guys, these are the bad guys, you know, is a little bit of a fallacy. Like it's messy, just like America is pretty messy. And so I think when you start going and you start picking apart the strands of America, you know, of our history, the thing that I always, you know, that I find moving when I read about this, when these issues, when I learn about these issues, is how human it all is. And so, you know, you started with kind of talking about Stonewall Jackson. You know, I think one of these little, and this is a sort of a moment of like humanity. So Stonewall Jackson, you know, in late 1862 into 1863, you know, the Confederates are sort of on a roll of battlefield victories and seem somewhat unstoppable despite their inferior numbers. And at the Battle of Chancellorsville, which is a huge Confederate victory, after the first night of the battle, Stonewall Jackson rides out to do he's going to do a night attack and finally, you know, kind of seal the deal with the Union. And he rides out past his own lines to do a reconnaissance. And as he's riding back into his own friendly lines, he's shot by a Confederate sentry in the arm. A few days later, they amputate his arm, but a few days later, he dies of pneumonia. And one of the great alternate histories has always been, so that was in May of 1863, in July is Gettysburg. And if you go to the Gettysburg battlefield, where much of this novel kind of takes place in the history of Gettysburg and the stories around Gettysburg, on the first day of the battle, there was some high ground. And General Lee said basically to Stonewall Jackson's replacement, his exact orders were, take the high ground if practicable. Those had been picked over for years because the high ground was not taken. But historians have said, you know, if Stonewall Jackson had been there, knowing him, and he was known as a very, you know, sort of aggressive forward in the saddle, like he would have taken that high ground. And had he taken that high ground, you know, likely chance the Confederates could have beat the Northern troops there. Likely chance then, you know, the Civil War would have had a different outcome. Anyway, and this whole cascade of events. Now, I'm not saying that's definitely what would happen, but I think it shows our proclivity, particularly as Americans on some of these issues, to always imagine these, you know, what what could have happened? How radically different could our country be? And I think that's such an American thing to do because, you know, we are a country of dreamers, of people who sort of come here and, you know, made a nation that's not like many other countries, a blood and soil nation. We're we're a nation that just sort of keeps building itself out of ideas and out of the stories that we tell. So I'm, as you can tell, endlessly fascinated by these topics.
Yeah. And I guess I'll go back to my kind of pitch for you as an author, which is that you're, I think you're really balancing past, present, and future. Present with your Atlantic writing, future with 2034, 2054, and then obviously Halcyon and this style of stuff with history. How does the conversation we just had about the Spanish-American War's role in national reconciliation, a lot of the writing you're doing about future conflicts and ways that the issues we're seeing in the Russia-Ukrainian war really presaging what the future could really look like, how does that really unify with your concerns about national unity? Because this seems to be all, I think the thing that makes this era really interesting is you have all these commingling variables just mixed together. And it's difficult to have just a clear takeaway.
I think that's
so
right.
Give me that clear takeaway is basically what I'm saying.
Yeah, I hate to break it to you. I think the truth lies in complexity, you know? That's what I find fascinating about, you know, writing about telling stories is so there is, you know, why do we tell stories? We tell stories to make meaning out of very complicated events for which oftentimes there isn't true meaning. I mean, it's a way that human beings order chaos is we take a bunch of chaotic events and the way we organize them is into a story. So know if there is, you know, one clear through line on any of this, aside from just having an awareness of the different stories that are being told and the different narratives that are being propagated, as opposed to sort of what I think is sort of the enemy, which is believing that issues are black and white and that one side is wholly good and the other side is wholly evil. Because that's not, I mean, as you know, like that's not true. You know, the truth lies in complexity.
I guess what I'm curious about is where are you from? And I'm asking that in the sense that I know just from like having read your books, like you spent some time growing up in London, but so much of the discourse in the writing in the book is really rooted in where people are from. Like, you know, there's a professor friend who's he's from Mississippi. So when he's writing about the Civil War, that's obviously going to impact how he approaches and thinks about that topic, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So where are you rooted in terms of this country and how does that shape how you look at our history?
Oh man, you're only asking the hard questions today. Actually never known how to answer that one. If someone asks me where I'm from, Marshall, I was born in Los Angeles. I grew up in London. I moved there when I was 9. I moved back to the States when I was 15 to Washington, D.C. And then I left for college, Boston, Marines, North Carolina. I've lived overseas for a few years. I've sort of moved every 5 years. So I guess I would, you know, my mother's family are all Christians and my father's families are all Jews. So I think I'm just sort of that like distinctly American breed of mongrel that's not necessarily from like one particular place. I'm speaking to you today from Washington, D.C. And I think that has, it gives you certain advantages in that I know throughout my life, I've always known I can move around with relative ease. If you were to tell me tomorrow that I had to go live in, I don't know, Budapest, I'd probably be fine with it and make myself pretty comfortable there. But the downside is, you know, I have many people I love who are really from a place. Like my wife is really from Wilmington, Delaware. You know, her whole family is from Wilmington. They are deeply, deeply rooted in that place. And I see the benefit of having those types of deep roots. But I think if you were to ask me what the perspective is from which I'm trying to look at these distinctly American issues, I think I'm trying to, as a writer, wear effectively with as much empathy and intelligence as possible, you know, the masks of each of my characters. You know, when I'm writing a character, no matter how good or reprehensible they are, when they step onto the page, you know, they are making their case before the reader as though they're making their case before God. Like, that's my job, is to let them make their case. And so I think that forces me, you know, when I'm writing, to be from, you know, from many places and to hold many perspectives in my mind.
Man, that's so fascinating. Something we get from listeners are lots of, we do this like Q&A function for the podcast, and we get lots of questions about fiction, and we can never give a proper answer because me and Sagar and I are desperately underrepresented when it comes to fiction, and we can't keep on recommending The Three-Body Problem and Ender's Game to people. So can you just talk about fiction for a second?
I love Ender's Game.
Yeah, it's a cliche. It's like, obviously, oh, you like Foreign Policy, Foreign Affairs? Like, I was a 12-year-old too. I thought I was so smart. So, but now that I'm actually speaking with a fiction author who's still rooted in the like policy, public affairs stuff that the podcast is mostly focused on, can you just kind of like talk to those listeners? Like, what, and when I'm talking about listeners, I'm saying like these tend to be college kids who are like, hey, like, I'm kind of getting more into reading. I'm doing lots of Audible. Like, talk to them about fiction, wherever you want to take it.
Well, I'll tell you an anecdote about Ender's Game, and then we can talk about fiction.
I was
sort of a classic, I don't know, like boy who didn't read a lot. I just wasn't into it. I wanted to be outside. I wanted to be hanging out with my friends. And so my father, when he was kind of running herd on me and my brother over the weekends, he would make us read in our room for an hour. And I would often just sit there and like stare at the walls. And so one of the books he gave me to read was Ender's Game. And I didn't read it. And then I sort of, I don't know, however many hours had passed that I thought was convincing to convince him that I'd read it. I said, hey, Dad, you know, I finished Ender's Game. He's like, oh, yeah. What'd you think of it? I was like, pretty good. Pretty good. He's like, what'd you think of that ending? I was like, good ending. Good ending. Like, and if anyone knows, like, Ender's Game is like one of the greatest endings of all time with, like, I think a pretty amazing plot twist where the whole book comes into focus in the last few pages and you understand this world you've been in a totally different way. So if you're listening and you haven't read Ender's Game, I couldn't recommend it enough. But so anyways, I had not read the end of Ender's Game, and I went back and read it, and it blew me away. So anyways, there's hope for all of us. Listen, I think what I write fiction, I write nonfiction, I do journalism. Fundamentally, writing, you're trying to tell a story. And you're trying to tell a story that I try to write the types of books that I enjoy reading, frankly. Mm. And the books that I enjoy reading, I think, leave me at the end sort of, I shut the book and I'm kind of find myself looking at a subject a little bit differently, and sitting there with a lot of questions. And so when it comes to writing fiction, I think what's so you're trying to create the same effect, I think, in any type of story, whether it's fiction or nonfiction. But obviously, in fiction, anything can happen. Now, at the beginning of a novel, you know, you, from the first sentence, you start putting up constraints around yourself, right? Just little choices like, okay, am I going to tell this in the first person or in the third person? Who's my narrator going to be? What's the time frame? What's the structure of the book? So immediately, as soon as you start putting form around a story, you know, it has rules and constraints. You know, it's not just finger painting at that point. There are rules around what you're going to do. But within fiction, obviously, the great rule that you can always break is this, you know, none of this stuff had to have happened. So that allows you to go in many different directions. But the effect you're trying to make with the reader, I think, is always the same effect, which is them being immersed in a story that's going to stay with them.
You know, something I'm curious about, this show is called The Realignment. We're really focusing on helping people understand the world. Time is difficult. Everyone's really busy. So there's all these podcasts and there's all these like fiction books to read and nonfiction books to read. I was just thinking about this as I was listening to your book on my morning walk, just because I've spent a lot of time. I'm doing like a hardcore, like Asia Pacific, World War II, kind of deep dive. So lots of Pacific theater stuff. And I was listening to a fiction book on the walk, which I don't typically do. I was like, oh, this is like a different experience. Like, I'm thinking about things differently. I'm not quite memorizing facts in the same way. Which helps? And this isn't like an either or answer, but does fiction or nonfiction help you better comprehend the world and understand how things are, or interpret how things are going around you?
I don't want to say better or not better, but I would say that you know, a couple of historians I know have both independently made the point to me that when they're going back and they're trying to really just understand, like, what was it like to live in time X? They don't sit there and you know, they'll read the history, know the history, but they'll go read novels that were written at that time, because novels are so much a mapping of the interiority of characters and of story. So, you know, if I want to know what it was like to live in the Gilded Age, I could go read a whole bunch of, you know, histories of Gilded Age New York, right? Mm-hmm. If I really want to know what it felt like to live in the Gilded Age, yeah, I go read some Edith Wharton. Like, mm-hmm. I feel like that would give me some Henry James. Like, that's going to really let me feel like I've got my finger on the pulse and I know what it's like to walk into a room and what that room would feel like at that time. So I think I read a blend of both. But I feel like probably on the whole, walk away from fiction with sort of, you know, more truths that I kind of carry with me well into the future than, you know, when I'm just reading histories. But like I was just saying, you know, having sat there and listened to the entire, you know, Civil War narrative for 9 months, like, that was an amazing experience that, you know, really, opened up my understanding of those 4 years of American history.
Why was that your New Year's? Was that preparation for this book, or you were just like, this is a tome of like, this is one of those things, you like, why did you choose that one?
Sort of a little inside baseball, but the life opens up in weird ways. You know, I'd always seen the Ken Burns documentary, and it's brilliant. You know, even the people I think have like poo-pooed it a little. I mean, it's brilliant. You know, if you haven't watched it, you got to watch it. It's amazing.
It's on Amazon Prime, people, so you can make this happen pretty easy.
Yeah, pretty easy. And it's actually, if you look at it, it is basically what Ken Burns did. And a lot of people talk about this. He basically adapted Shelby Foote's book, A Narrative History of the Civil War. I mean, and the end, I mean, there's whole passages that are very much lifted from the Shelby Foote book. And actually the very final episode, the way the whole documentary ends is a lift from the way A Narrative History of the Civil War ends. So I watch it and I see it as adapted, but the way I'd always known this connection to the documentary. I always, you know, because I'm a military man by background, knew that sort of reading being able to say you had read Shelby Foote's Civil War, A Narrative History, was like one of the great reading challenges out there. It's like being able to say, you know, I read all of Proust. But I also knew, like, I'm never going to do it. So over the years, Shelby's son, Yuji Foote, became a friend of mine, and he's a very talented fine arts photographer. Actually, he did the author photo on Halcyon, and has done a couple of my author photos, and I have nice. Some of his photography in my home. So he's a dear friend of ours. And, we were a few years ago sitting around kind of the table in our apartment. And it was right before Christmas, and I was catching up with Yuji, who lives in Memphis. And he said, hey, you know, it's actually pretty exciting. They're re-releasing on Audible my father's narrative history, unabridged. And I was like, Jesus Christ, like, how long is that? He's like, it's 152 hours, Elliot, you know? And I was like, but then I was like, you know what? New Year's is coming up. Like, I've always wanted to be able to do this. Like, I could do 3 hours a week, 3 hours a week. I could do that when I'm at the gym, when I'm on the subway. So I made it my New Year's resolution to just listen to the whole thing. And it was a great experience.
So for the last few questions, this is something I was really, really curious about at an author level. You spent I think the 2000s, you're an interesting person to write about the 2000s, because you literally, beyond, you know, being in North Carolina, we're not there for this period, in the sense of the war on terror, like, you're in Iraq. I'm like, oh, like, you were probably in Fallujah, like, during like this time period, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. How do you interpret the 2000s, and how is it just to write about them? Just give, because I feel like you were probably just checked out. Like, for example, I do not think you spent 2002 thinking about bioethics debates, in the sense. So how do you think about writing about that?
No, I didn't. I got asked a couple of years ago to be a talking head on the CNN, the 2000s, which made me feel really old.
That's so funny. Like, you know, that's a great series. It's a great series.
No, it's a great series. I feel like, oh, I should wear my, like, I'm like, what do I have that's like 2000 vintage? Like, if I was the one in like the 90s, I would have like my Reebok pumps or something like
that. Yeah.
I felt like I was present for it. I certainly felt like I was present for events that kind of pinged in the 2000s, like the Iraq War. I was in Katrina as a Marine. They sent me down to Hurricane Katrina, like just 3 days after the storm. Israel invaded Lebanon. Actually, a friend of mine is a writer, Phil Klei. I don't know if you're familiar with his work.
Yeah. But he will often, had him on the show.
Yeah. Okay. He's great. But Phil often teased me. He's like, Elliot, you were like the Forrest Gump of the 2000s. Because particularly when I was in the Marines, I just sort of wound up being where certain things were happening. But I think it makes you, it makes you feel a little bit, it just makes you realize the passage of time when you're writing about events that to you in your memory seem relatively present, but you kind of head check yourself like, no, that was like 20 years ago. So, and I think that's one of the reasons why I wanted to set the novel in an alternate 2004. Because when you say it, at least when I don't know if what I say it to you, it doesn't really seem that long ago. Like, oh, 2004. But then you realize like, actually that's history.
It just hit me as this is the first year that this feels like old to me, at least.
It's putting a mark saying actually war is now history. So it's, sort of like the great truism Marty McFly's DeLorean, when he goes back to 1983.
He goes back to the 50s.
He goes back, he goes from the 80s into the 50s. But like, it's like that was 30 years. I'm like, what is that, from now? So it's, it's just realizing that as time passes and, you get older, you will have witnessed history. And I guess I'm nodding to that in the book too.
So the last question is going to be totally out of left field, but it just so speaks to what the podcast has really focused on lately. I loved your Atlantic. There's no easy pivot for this. I loved your Atlantic piece on the arsenal of democracy. So just given the fact that we're normally like a policy focused podcast, I'd love for you just like in these last few minutes, just to sort of like unpack your writing on the arsenal of democracy defense production topic, because just from my perspective as like a DC foreign policy think tanker, it seems that like this is the like critical issue of this moment of your focus on this space. So I'd just love to hear your quick finishing perspective on it.
Oh, well, thank you. I'm glad you enjoyed that article. I think for that article for Atlantic, I was down in Camden, Arkansas, and visited the Lockheed plant where they make HIMARS and all the attendant munitions that are being used right now in Ukraine. And it was just sort of an opportunity to go and just really see like, okay, let's see like how is this stuff built? And I think I walked away from that kind of with two conclusions. First of all, I think sometimes as Americans, because we have this sort of sense of our nation as being the one that outproduced every other country in the Second World War and then beat the Soviets in the Cold War, that we just sort of have these factories churning out weapons at all time, and our arsenal of democracy, it's really just a matter of like, taking the switch from low production and turning it to high production, and off these things will run. And that is like not the case. And as impressive and hardworking as those folks down in Camden are, like, these are people with drilling holes into metal and putting these HIMARS together like Erector sets. I mean, there's only so fast they can assemble these weapon systems. And so I think it was for me, just a nice wake up call to recognize that as the world becomes a much more dangerous place, we as a country are going to have to make, real strategic decisions about how much we want to invest in our industrial base. And simply saying that the military industrial complex is an inherent evil and we're not going to invest in these capabilities, I think that is probably lazy, lazy and non-strategic thinking. We need to, it's worthwhile to really understand what goes into, what goes into rolling these types of platforms off the line and making sure that we are ready to respond to any threats, whether they be Ukraine or Taiwan. So I think that is a real question for ages. How are we reinvesting in the country? So. Yeah, I'll tell you one funny thing about that piece, sort of behind the scenes. Give you a little color for you and your listeners. Was I broke my toe the day before I had to go write that piece, and so the entire time I was on the floor of that Lockheed plant, I was wearing my house slippers. So the it's always like the sublime mixed with the ridiculous, because I was like hobbling around this Lockheed plant where they're, you know, retrofitting HIMARS, and I can barely walk. And the only thing I can put my foot into is a house slipper. So sometimes journalism can be very perilous.
It's a very Forrest Gump, Gump of you. Yeah. No, I think that I wanted to start with that piece just because we've had, this is me speaking to listeners, like we've had Bridge Colby on, we've had a bunch of debates around like this trade-off between the Asia Pacific and Europe. And I think the piece just really illustrates the wonky themes. And I like, this is how this is actually being experienced like on the ground. So for folks who listen to those episodes we've done on those, like I think this is the perfect follow-up to those. So glad we could shout out most of your writing. Elliot, this has been really great. Always a pleasure to have you on. We'll keep having you on when you have a new book out, which once again seems to be a once a year kind of step functions. We'll just kind of keep that up.
No, thanks. It's always great to come on. And yeah, I would love to come on in a bit to talk to you about 2054.
Hope you enjoyed this episode. If you learned something, like the sort of mission, or want to access our subscriber-exclusive Q&A, bonus episodes, and more, go to realignment.supercast.com and subscribe to our $5 a month, $50 a year, or $500 for a lifetime membership rates. See you all next time.